Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're going to talk about flying and fighting, but from a different angle that isn't obvious. Information's role in air combat. And to be blunt, information is everything. In World War I and World War II, a fighter pilot was only as good as his eyeballs, because that was the primary sensor that alerted him to the threat and set off the intellectual chain of events regarding how to engage for the kill, maneuver the aircraft, and then take the shot. With the advent of radar, initial forms of computer processing, and data links, things began to change a lot. Now today, the advanced information advantage will likely make the difference between life and death for a pilot in combat. And while this might be obvious to most airmen, it's generally lost on the public at large. When most folks see a fighter sitting on the ramp, they basically look the same. They're pointy and fast. But the biggest difference most people notice comes down to the color of the paint scheme. And this lack of understanding has led to major challenges for how the United States Air Force and the other services articulate their modernization challenges. Almost everything that yields crucial advantages in the modern era isn't about the physical aerodynamic performance. We nailed that years ago. It really comes down to the information advantage, and all of that is hidden underneath the skin of the airplane. So, to help me explain what I'm talking about, I've invited three friends of our show to talk about this from their own lane of experience. First off, I've got Mitchell's Director of Research, Major General, retired, Larry Stutz Stutzstream, who started flying the F-4, and then he went to the F-16, and then wrapped up his career in the A-10.
Hey, Slick, thanks. It's great to be back. I love what you do.
Also joining us is Heather Lucky Penny from our team, and she flew the F-16.
Slick, thanks. It's great to be here.
And finally, we've got Justin Hazard Lee, who, as you may remember, flies the F-35, but he also has some time in the F-16 early on in his career.
Hey, Slick, thanks for having me back on.
We've got multiple decades of air combat covered, from the Cold War in the F-4 to the cutting edge of today in the F-35. So, Stutz, I want to kick this off with you. We're talking about how fighters have evolved through the generations, and perhaps what's the most significant is the development of how information is presented to the pilots. And you flew one of the first generations of fighters to really have a lot of information available to the aircrew. And I remember the first time I saw the Phantom cockpit, and I was looking at all these dials and gauges. It was super complex to me. Obviously, I knew the round dials that were going to tell me how to fly, but from a tactical perspective and a sensor's perspective, I had no idea what I was looking at. So tell me what it was like to strap into an F-4 and go fly a mission as a young lieutenant. My guess is it would have been cutting edge when it was fielded at the end of the 50s, but by managing all those sensors and making sense of it all demanded a lot of the pilot and WISO or weapon system operator to be working the airplane.
Man, Slick, what you just said is a great description of what it was like. And I'll harken back, you know, the flying, you know, what we see as the public, the Thunderbirds doing, becomes second nature and ingrained to a fighter pilot. It's very reflexive. The real magic is in the tactics, making sense of what's in the battle space, you know, maneuvering to some aim, you know, whether you're going to shoot or bomb or chase somebody away. That killing and surviving is maybe 90% or more of the task load that the pilot has in the cockpit. And to do that is all about the information coming at you, making sense of it and acting on what it means as a whole. So, you know, the information that I managed in the F-4 in my first 3 or 4 years was very difficult to acquire some skill in building and maintaining situational awareness. That was probably 70%, I would say, of my mental capacity just devoted to that. You know, as an example, back then, no GPS. We had maps, grease pencils. We used our wristwatches to make sure we stayed on those black lines of navigation. And even later, when we had navigation avionics, they needed to be continually backed up, you know, because they were not reliable. So we were working the maps and timing anyway. But anyway, the information in the F-4 cockpit, as you were saying, was coming at me. It was like 1,000 spikes to my brain. Every system I had gave me some data, but none of it was brought together. I had to scan them, listen to the beeps and squeaks of warning in my headphones. I'm scanning around all those analog dials you mentioned. splashed everywhere in the cockpit. There's the radar, there's other scopes and systems, but I had to make sense of all of it in my own brain. And most importantly, I have to add, the most important input, data input, was with my eyes. Because of our weapons and systems, we were expected to fight in close quarters, say within, you know, a couple miles, several miles maybe. So the eyes at some point were critical in picking up an adversary or defending yourself. So outside the cockpit, Slick, that's interesting too. You know, I'm talking just about what's in my cockpit. Outside the cockpit, there's all this data and it's coming toward me on the radios, and it's by voices. And all that, as you know, is often jammed by adversaries and it's terribly congested. So in a complex zone of operations, we could only understand a small share of what was going on. And to be honest, our awareness back in that day was confined to a really small radius, maybe 30 miles, maybe less. And it wasn't with a, you know, high degree of confidence. So it was critical, of course, in the F4 to divide all these overwhelming tasks with a second person, which we call the weapon systems officer, who sat in the back of the aircraft. And that person took over the duties of radar search, navigation, ran a lot of the weapon subsystems. But that WISO was another feed of data into my brain. I had to listen to, we had to coordinate carefully, and it was just one more stream. Even then, at times, with both of us in that aircraft, the streams of information could be overwhelming. At times, I would turn down volumes, turn off radios, just to keep my brain centered. So the information in the F4 environment was challenging and took a lot of time to get a handle on.
I can't even imagine the overwhelming information that you had to keep straight. Now, Lucky, I know that you've explored this era of technology quite a bit, and I'd like you to walk us through what you've learned about the architecture that the engineers at McDonald used to create this system, and how did it correlate with the mission set?
Well, Slick, this is something that people often forget, but the F-4, first and foremost, was a naval air interceptor designed to protect the carrier over the ocean. So sanitized airspace out to about 100 miles. Although the F-4 is remembered as iconic Air Force fighter from Vietnam, that's not what it was built for. The operational concept of that air defense interceptor, again, was these long-range intercepts about 200 miles. And remember, in fighter combat, range is time. So all of those systems that Stutz talked about, the idea was that the weapon system operator in the back seat would have the time and luxury of managing all those systems and had time to interpret them as well. So when the Air Force got the F-4 and we had to employ that in Vietnam as a multi-role fighter, we added a boatload more systems to the jet. There was no real processor in the F-4. And that's why it required two crew members, because with all of those systems, the task loading got really high. Because there was no architecture like we think of today, there was no software architecture. The engineers just tried to find space in the cockpit and put in a sensor or a dial or a gauge or a display. So managing all of these was manual. That was the job of the air crew. And you know what you both mentioned about the cockpit was right. I mean, it was just kind of a hot mess. The McDonnell engineers weren't thinking about what we call human factors today, how to design a cockpit to make it effective and efficient for the pilots to use. They were just looking at where stuff would fit. And this made the job of the aircrew even more complex, because they had to manually remember where all these systems were. The pilot flew and made the tactical decisions, and the WISO in the backseat was supposed to operate the systems. So that might have worked in a long-range intercept over the ocean, again, where the airspace was sanitized and you knew where the bad guys were coming from because the good guys were behind you. But it was really dysfunctional in the dense, high-threat, fast operational environment of Vietnam.
Well, Heather, I like that you you mentioned that you know, range equals time. And I know that the F-4 had an ashtray, you know, so there was the whole, he had time to smoke a Lucky, right? And I think that's where that came from. But so Stutz, can you verify, did the F-4 have an ashtray?
Well, I could tell you a story about an ops officer. I was taking off on his wing on a formation takeoff. He was renowned. He was one of the best bombers ever, you know, in the U.S. Air Force. And I was a young lieutenant, and we're climbing out of traffic. I'm on his wing. He looks over at me, drops his oxygen mask, takes his glove, stuffs it into the oxygen mask to make sure the oxygen is not coming out of it. And he lights up a cigarette, and he's looking, watching me at back. And I mean, he's off radio. He's off everything. We're just climbing out of traffic because we got about 15 minutes to get to a practice range. And he did smoke that lucky, but I don't know where he put the ashes. I just don't know.
Okay. Well, Stutz, talk to me what it meant from an aircrew perspective, because it sounds like there was a lot going on inside the F-4 cockpit, and I'm guessing it took years for folks to get really combat competent in the airplane. And this was an edge that took a long time to sharpen, and sounds like one that could be lost very fast.
Yeah, Slick. No, let me just say that we had tremendous talent and capabilities in the F-4. The air crews were very effective, but it took so much time. And your seniors in the squadron who were developing the young wingmen, they spent a lot of time, a lot of sorties, a lot of years getting to where they're at. A lot of people don't understand that, you know, an Air Force pilot earns their wings at undergraduate pilot training. They then wear those wings, but it means very little. They can just barely operate the aircraft. Years go on. So you have to understand that with the F-4, you were typically, you start out as a wingman, and your job is threefold. You need to fly that aircraft, provide more firepower to your leader, your flight leader, and then you're protecting the formation. You're helping to look out at the 6 o'clock position, which back then used to be where the threats would come, because the weapons at that time had to be employed from the rear quadrant of an aircraft, which is probably something Hazard has never probably trained to do, I would think. We'll have to see. To learn that killing and surviving, remember that's 90% of the workload, task load, skill set. A wingman's going to be a wingman, always supervised by an experienced flight lead or instructor, for maybe 2 years, 3 years before they say, hey, you've got enough going that we're going to put you into a two-ship flight lead program. And they might be in that program and leading for maybe another year or so, maybe 2 years, and then they can advance to four-ship flight lead. And so there's all these gates that the pilots were giving increasing levels of leadership and authority. And it took about 10 years, 12 years before a pilot and a WISO were leading large force packages in the F-4. And even then, even the more seasoned guys that were in the cockpit, you know, were really the ones you wanted to choose. And those large force packages involved, as you know, Slick, many aircraft, different types of aircraft. It took a lot of time to develop those skills, you know. And a lot of it was about doing that math and that fusion of information in the pilot's brain, and to be able to become proficient at building and maintaining situational awareness.
Yeah, it seems just like it's such an incredible task load to be on the individuals flying the airplanes versus the airplanes doing some of the work and the processing themselves. So we'll get Hazard in here. I know what he wanted to say when Stutz said, you know, when guys were behind me, you know, because that's where the missiles came from. I know Hazard was saying, well, I don't know, I've never had anybody rolling behind me before, so problem I never had to solve. I'm just kidding. But no, Hazard, I definitely want to get your thoughts in here on specifically talking about the F-4 and start contrasting that into what you've seen in the F-16. And of course, we're going to hit on the F-35 quite a bit.
Yeah, so the F-16, from my perspective, was kind of a rat's nest of technology. So it had 80s, 90s, 2000s technology all built in there. And every sensor was tied to a different screen. So it was really on the pilot to fuse all that data together. And consequently, we had a lot of CFIT in the F-16, controlled flight into terrain, where a pilot is misprioritizing, working their radar, and they run into a mountain. With the F-35, though, it fuses all that data together for you. So it just makes a green dot if it's a good guy, red dot if it's a bad guy. And to Stutz's point about the flying aspect, for him with his F4, it was taking 70% of his mental capacity to fly it. I would say with the F-35, it takes about 20%. So we have auto throttles, which are really helpful. So we can set it for a calibrated airspeed or a Mach number. So that can be tremendously helpful when we're flying. And there's a whole bunch of aspects like that for not only the basic flying, but for the ability to be tactical, to, as Stutz was saying, to kill the adversary and to survive.
I want to ask Lucky, what drove the differences between the F-4 and the F-16 as the quote, next generation of airplanes were built?
So like what Stutz just talked about regarding the time that it took to experience a fighter pilot and make them really tactically useful because they could manage all of the combat information necessary to kill and survive. Really, that's what drove the transformation from the third generation to the fourth generation, right? So if you think about the information and tactical load of the F-4 requiring two crew members, it meant every time an F-4 was shot down, we lost two people. It was a 2-to-1 loss ratio, right? So that's a significant attrition cost every time a single jet gets shot down. And so as the nation is looking at competing against the Soviet Union, understanding that we're going to continue to have attrition, they could not sustain that kind of pipeline because that experience is really valuable. Those experienced pilots are really valuable and it takes a long time to produce them, right? So if we're going to change that math equation so that instead of losing two pilots every time a jet gets shot down, you only lose one, we're going to have to go from a two-seat cockpit to a single-seat cockpit. So with that change, and remember, all the first fourth-generation fighters, the F-15, the F-16, and the A-10, I mean, they're all single-seat fighters. With that change, the Air Force also then had to reimagine how a single-seat fighter pilot could manage what became an increasingly complex weapon system. So how do you basically take the pilot and the WISO and make that one person? And that meant that the jet, how we designed the jet, how we designed the avionics and the processing, that had to change.
Yeah, and you know, honestly, I forgot about that 2-to-1 loss ratio, you know, initially in Vietnam with, I think you mentioned two pilots being in the airplane and having these tremendous losses. And now, you know, we transition, you know, navigators to become weapon systems officers and then putting them in the back just so that we weren't losing two pilots at a time. And it's so from a historical perspective, a great point to make that was such a forcing function. And Stutz, I want to ask you what it was like to then transition from the F-4 to the F-16, how the cockpit changed. And, you know, we think the Viper is, you know, getting to be an old jet today, but I'm guessing it was a huge leap from an information advantage perspective from the F-4 to the F-16.
Oh, Slick. I can talk about this all day. My first sortie in the F-16 was stunning. It was spectacular. It was exhilarating. I cherish my time in the F-4, but wow, I fell in love with the Viper on my first takeoff. On that first takeoff was out of Tampa, the MacDill Air Force Base. And air traffic control wanted us to do an afterburner climb to get quickly up to altitude for some other traffic. Flight lead asked me, am I ready to do that? I go, sure. And it was amazing. We took off full afterburner in that, you know, slick, fast sports car and straight up like a rocket. And that was it. It had me. Could pull 9 Gs. It was the dogfighter of dogfighters, as we even think about dogfighting back in World War I, World War II, very much designed at the apex of being able to do those dogfights. So, but we're not talking about that. I know, Slick. We're talking about information in the cockpit and information in general. And I'll tell you, as soon as I flew that F-16, it was clear there was one amazing innovation that actually, you know, highlights this. It brought together a number of all those disparate gauges and dials and the beeps and squeaks and stuff that I had in the F-4. And it brought up into my field of view where I could be looking outside and I could see all this data brought together. And it was called a heads-up display, the first generation of the heads-up display. And for the first time, it seemed the cockpit was designed around me, not the other way around. And it brought, you know, key information about speed, altitude, weapons parameters, radio frequencies, you know, what direction I should go. And then at the same time, I could avoid obstacles and I could look for adversaries. It was revolutionary. But still, all that information was from my airplane, my cockpit. I still had to take in all this outside stuff, information, threat information, what was going on in other formations through my radios, through my ears. And I still had to process this in my head quite a bit, but the WISO was gone. And as Heather said, the WISO could be gone, that backseater could be gone because it was engineered. I could control all this by myself as a single seat pilot. I'll say just a quick war story, really quick here, you know, to illustrate what Heather said, the F-4. I was at Cope Thunder as a young wingman. I mean, a very young wingman. And Cope Thunder is in the Philippines. It was in the Philippines on the island of Luzon. And we'd start these large force exercises up at about 30,000 feet. And fight would be on. And you're going into this realistic training scenario. And all of a sudden, you've got AWACS, the airborne warning guys with their radars calling out traffic. We've only got three radios. One is an emergency radio. One is to talk to. And so there's people screaming, break right, break left. They're calling out locations of threats. You've got jammers. You've got the guys doing air operations above you talking. You've got... like I said, the jammers, by the way, would get more intense as you got closer to them. And then you start getting illuminated by threats. And now your warning systems are going off. And I had to turn stuff off just to keep my brain straight in that cockpit. And at times I would be so saturated by all of this information. Remember, I'm trying to manage the cockpit at the same time, too, that at that time we had aggressor pilots. And on this sortie, I look over, I see this aggressor pilot about 300 feet off my wing, and he's waving at me. We have not even observed this guy. We're at 300 feet, by the way, on the deck, and we haven't even had the time to properly look outside the cockpit for threats, and the guy was just camped there, and I was a laughing stock in the debrief in front of hundreds of people, but that's how you make good fighter pilots from baby fighter pilots. Slick, you know that.
Well, Lucky and Hazard, I want you to jump in here because we all flew the F-16 and we are what the old guys like Stutz would call us, HUD babies. You know, we all appreciate the value that the green stuff is giving us through that heads up display. What was your experience employing the F-16? Lucky, how do you see the evolution of the F-16 from the F-4?
It's like the F-16, as I said, was designed as a response to the F-4. A single seat dogfighter, not only was its maneuverability revolutionary, but how pilots were presented and how they could use combat information was. The HUD, like what Stux talked about, is one example. You know, the F-16 was also very hands-on stick and throttle, HOTAS. You remember that? You know, we could manage all of the sensors and weapons and information without even taking our hands off the flight controls. We had all these little buttons on the stick and the throttle, and we called it playing the piccolo. But that was also revolutionary because it meant that we didn't have to be cranium down in the cockpit watching where our fingers were going to be touching buttons, right? We could keep our eyes in the fight as we changed from air-to-ground mode to air mode, or as we switched through various displays and sensor and weapon modes, right? But we still had to manually manage our sensors and make sense of the information in our own brains. We were human information processors. And that meant that everyone had their own unique picture of the battle space, depending on how skillful and experienced they were in managing and interpreting their sensors, how well they listened to and integrated those radio calls, and how they built that four-dimensional picture in their mind. And it was still a skill that took years to develop. I started in the F-16 just before we had data links. So even as advanced as the F-16 cockpit was, I mean, we didn't need a WISO anymore. It was still a major challenge to make sure that everyone in the flight had the same mental picture of what was going on in the battle space. you could land and go into debrief and everyone had a different idea of what the threat presentation was, different idea of how that intercept went down, right? Because it was all about the picture you built in your brain. This mattered because sharing a common battle space picture, this helps us synchronize decision-making and tactics. So when we finally got data links, having that common picture helped us be much more effective because everyone in the flight had a shared understanding. And it really expanded our situational awareness beyond what our radars could see. So with data links today, we can now begin to experiment with detached mutual support, formations that are outside of visual range. And this increase in shared battle space awareness, again, it goes beyond what our radars can see. And as we have more integration across those data links, it can make us more effective and open up new tactical options.
Sure. And Hazard, I assume you came into the F-16 and had data link from the beginning, or where were you with the SA building with that experience?
Yeah, when I joined with the B course, we were flying, I think it was M4.3. So it was the first jet to have Link 16, which was a godsend. It wasn't perfect, and often we fell off the link, so we'd have to revert back to non-link tactics, but that really increased situational awareness. And when link went down, you probably had only 15, 20% of the SA you did before. So I can remember flying at red flags as a wingman, link going down at night, and then just trying to stare at my flight lead through night vision goggles and not being useful at all. So I think with the F-16, it was a really steep learning curve. And with the F-35, we have Link 16 as a backup, we have MATL, it's bulletproof, and you can really spend your time focusing on how I can be tactical and how I can kill the enemy out there, as opposed to just worrying about flying formation. So it's really helpful to be able to share all that information together. And that's something that I don't think most people understand. Most people think that it's all, when I go to an air show, they ask, how fast can it fly? How high can it fly? But it's really about situational awareness. And it's about nodes and networks. And that's one of the things they found in the early days of the internet, is that a network's value was equal to the square of the number of nodes. So if you had 10 nodes, you would have like 100 bits of data, I call it. If you had 100 nodes, you'd have 10,000. So it's exponential. So you want to have all these sensors out there. And if you can pair it with a shooter as well, then you're talking about not just having a kill chain, but a kill web, which is much more durable.
Hey, Slick, I've got a question for you. You're a weapons school instructor, experienced at using information at the most elite levels. And you also led the initial cadre that developed the initial F-35 tactics. So how did you think about exploiting the information that the F-35 could bring to the fight? What was it like to integrate and employ information at that level?
Oh, okay. I got to go back here, and I appreciate getting to answer a question on the podcast for change. So just going back in history quick, my role as an instructor at the weapons school was the F-35 tactics development team lead. So I was the first guy in charge of doing that, which was really, really cool because I had a cadre of folks from the different squadrons within the weapons school. So, we had F-22, A-10, other F-16 guys, Strike Eagle folks. And our job was to begin to think about how to tactically employ the F-35. And so we were all read in the program, and I would go to Lockheed Martin for 1 week every month for about almost 18 months. And we're flying integrated simulators and begin to develop the F-35 3-1. So going back to that time at the weapons school, to your point, we had wonderful, wonderful skilled instructors there. So just for the listeners that don't understand the weapons school, it's just like the movie Top Gun. We just don't call it Top Gun, but very few people they're typically the ace of their base. They get selected to go through weapons school. And so the instructors that I work with were just like Maverick at the end of the movie that get invited to go back to teach. So obviously very, very skilled. So looking back at my time in the F-16 at the weapons school, I got to fly with folks that were incredibly skilled. And this, a four ship of F-16s at the weapons school would crush any four ship, out there in the combat air force, just because the folks were so in tune with the airplane and could fly it so well. And like you said, at the highest level, because we got to integrate with the rest of the, you know, the combat air force every day. We would walk down the hall and you'd have the same level of expertise from the F-22 division or the F-15 division. And so we were just integrating. And the level, to answer your question, was in the F-35, and Stutz mentioned this, where he was, you know, really managing his airplane and his four-ship, but the F-35 was such a quantum leap when we would go to these simulators, because as Stutz mentioned, he had like a 30-mile bubble around his airplane. At the weapons school, integrating with all those other squadrons, you know, very close with the Barnyard, the AWACS squadron. You know, now we're tied into this network, still through the radios, but we're talking to AWACS, who's seeing, you know, 100+ miles away, and integrating that as a skilled aviator, that information into my cockpit. Well, in the F-35, in a four-ship, now you have four airplanes that have more situational awareness than probably anybody else in the battle space, because they're seeing well beyond what an AWACS can see. They don't have to share the information that they're seeing with the other airplanes via the radio, because the airplanes are displaying what each other airplane are seeing and building this incredible picture to be able to tactically engage upon. So just a very, very different level of information sharing. It was just absolutely tremendous. I know we're kind of getting long here, and I want to wrap it up with talking to Hazard, because I know you're going to make us all really jealous when you tell us what it's like to hop in the cockpit of the newest fifth gen fighter, the F-35. And I'm guessing it's going to be much like Stutz mentioned when he went from the F-4 to the F-16, but it's obviously got to be much bigger.
Yeah, it feels like you're in a shot of ours. So in the F-16, we just had a narrow view of what was going on, especially if we didn't have Link, you could just see raw data hits on your radar and maybe lock a few of those up. And then afterwards, you would all get together. And then when you're in the debrief, you would see a big screen with everything that was going on. Well, the F-35 is like that. So you're flying, you have all that situational awareness because the jet has great sensors and it fuses all that data together, which is a huge aspect. And then with our helmets, we have augmented reality to make that even easier to interpret the data. And then also we have stealth. So we deny our enemy the ability to see that with us. So it's really not a fair fight when you're going in there, which is exactly what we want.
And Hazard, I want to pile onto that. And, you know, we've been so focused on, you know, the individual pilot as we're kind of thinking about this in the individual airplane, but what there's got to be a lot going on behind the scenes with the airplanes, how they're talking to each other. You mentioned Mattel, you mentioned Link 16. So how is this like collaborative effort going on in this kill web that you mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're sharing all the data back and forth with us, and we're sharing with the legacy fighters like the F-15, the F-16. So those fighters, fortune fighters, they're going to be around till at least the late 2040s and probably even longer. So it's really about being able to integrate with them together and raise the bar for everybody. So sharing that data amongst everybody. So we can go out there, we can go and kill a particularly bad threat, or we can sit back and we can have fortune assets use their missiles, their gas to take out enemy fighters or SAM sites.
All right, so all of you are familiar with this technology. Where do you see it going next? What do you think F-35 pilots 10 years from now will be talking about in the information realm?
10 years from now, and actually even right now, information is the coin of the realm. So as we look into the future, we're going to see information not only continue to be revolutionized within the F-35 cockpit, but we will see information across the battle space and how we gather that. Unmanned systems, a lot of smaller autonomous aircraft, we'll see them flying in formation and in collaboration with each other and with F-35s. This is really where the future is going, and how we harness that is going to be a key combat advantage. Like the kill webs that Hazard talked about, this is what the future is bringing, is just more information.
Well, Slick, I don't have a lot to say compared to what you and Hazard can talk to. I just hearken back to having flown the F-4 and early F-16s. So much is opened, as Heather just described, new technologies and new concepts. And I think in 10 years, that's where the F-35 and the F-35 pilots and all that support them are going to be focused. And that's on innovating new operating concepts, innovating new tactics, expanding, bringing together more and more capabilities. And so I think there is a lot to be done in that airplane, which has liberated the pilots to think big.
You know, Slick, and I'm going to add one more thing here, is that we're talking a lot about information, but as Stutz opened up at the very beginning of the podcast, information is all about killing and surviving. It's about achieving effects in the battle space. So as much as we love the Trons and as much as we love the data, it's how we use it and how we employ it that matters.
All right, Hazard, F-35 in 10 years, go.
So I just came back from the Lockheed factory, walking the line, and I had a chance to talk with the chief engineer for the F-35, Santi Bullness, and he was ecstatic about all the upgrades that they're putting into the jet. So these things are like Tesla. So there's not a new model that comes out every year. Whenever they have a new fix, they put it into the line, and there are hundreds of new fixes that they put into the line every year. And he was really excited about everything going into Block 4, Block 5. He was saying that this is going to be a completely different animal, and everything is software dependent. So I can remember when I first joined the program, I was flying 2B jets. So those were pre-production software, and it wasn't that great. And then overnight we got a software update and the sensors got better. We could pull more G's. It unlocked the gun. So all these things came from software. So it's all about having great software, which drives that situational awareness. And there are a lot of great upgrades in the pipe coming soon.
Okay, so now I'm going to put all of you on the spot. And let's say each one of you had a meeting with an F-35 skeptic that said, fifth gen's too expensive. We need to dial it back and buy something more like an F-16 or an F-15. Because we see this happening on all the time, ranging from, you know, members in Congress to just the average person who wants to rant on social media. So we'll go down the line. We'll go Stutz, Heather, Hazard, and then we'll close this one out. So what do you want to tell somebody that is a skeptic and thinks the F-35 is just not worth it?
Well, Slick, look, I respect every man and woman who serves their country. And just because they are asked to make the ultimate sacrifice of their life fast doesn't mean we set them up to die meaninglessly. And I take this very much from a moral point of view. We owe the 1% of serve a chance to survive in war. And buying new old design aircraft is a clear message in my mind that you will not survive a fight. With the Chinese or Russians or anyone else who flies their equipment, their advanced equipment. So I truly do not understand the ambiguity of our leaders saying our service members are our most important resource, and then they send them into combat at a stunning disadvantage. It's troubling to say the least, and I would make that case to any level of decision maker or to the public to help them understand what it means to put a fighter pilot in the latest and greatest technology.
Well, that's a pretty powerful point, Stutz. Never thought about it that way, but it makes absolute sense.
Yeah, you know, Slick, I just have to echo what Stutz says. I mean, if we're going to send our young women and men into combat, we owe it to them so that they can go into bad guy land, execute their mission successfully, and come home safely. And so we need to resource them to be able to do that. And to that point, what Stutz was saying, you know, this isn't simply just about going backwards in terms of aircraft design, taking legacy fighter types and stuffing them with new guts. A lot of the conversation within the defense space has been about putting a pause on F-35, whether or not that's dramatically ramping down production or even prematurely terminating it in order to save money and invest that into future technologies, those next generation aircraft. I'm here to tell you that paper airplanes are always cheaper than real airplanes. You know, and according to the PowerPoint, those paper airplanes that the ones in production don't have right now. So we've been coasting on Reagan era fighters for the last 30 to 40 years. And I have to ask myself, when was the last time a major weapon system was delivered on time. We've forgotten that every new program has some teething issues, and working through some of those technological difficulties might be challenging, but it's worth it. And we also have to remember that the technologies that we're working on maturing and smoothing out today are the ones that become the foundation for the next generation. So we've got to stay committed to what we have in production today, both the F-35 and the B-21, if we're going to make it to that next generation. Plus, I'm here to tell you, the world is only getting more complex and contentious. People have been saying we can take risks today to invest in the future. And that's always just been a rolling 5 to 10 to 15 years, right? Just keeps rolling along. Take risks today, take risks today. I'm telling you what, the future is here today and we cannot afford to take risk any longer.
Yeah, so I would say, what piece of technology that's 40 years old would you bet your life on around you? If you're going to a race, you're not going to bring a 60s Corvette. Even if you gut out the engine, put in a new engine, it's not going to win a race against a modern Corvette. Same thing with a fifth gen fighter. So a fourth gen fighter is not survivable. It's not survivable in the modern MESs, missile engagement zones out there, because a lot of these aspects have to be baked in. You can't just replace a computer in a fourth gen fighter and expect it to be survivable. So it has to be baked in from the initial design. And I would say the proof is in the end user. So talk to any current fighter pilot out there that is integrated in some of these large exercises like Red Flag. They will all say that the F-35 is extremely valuable. So I don't know of any F-35 pilots that say the F-16 is better. And that's now spread across all communities. So talk to current fighter pilots that have flown, you know, could be an F-16 pilot, could be an F-15 pilot that has flown with a 3F software plus F-35. And I guarantee they'll be fans of it.
Hazard, I'm going to steal a couple of your quotes. I may misquote them, but you know, I think one of the things that Heather said that reminded me of something that you said on your podcast, and for our listeners that aren't subscribing to your channel, I'm sure they would love it. So check out Hazard Lee. But one of the things that you said is, or Heather said, was, you know, that every new program has teething issues. And Hazard, on one of your discussions, you had said, you know, if we had social media back in the 70s and the 80s when the F-16 was growing up and we were losing, a couple a month for a while, the argument would have been, you know, to shut it down. But it obviously has proved to be an incredibly valuable airplane that the Air Force is still flying today. But, you know, there was the old saying of, you know, it was the Doritos commercial, crunch all you want, we'll make more, right? I mean, so we lost a lot of F-16s, and you know, luckily the F-35 is from a safety perspective and everything else is just continuing to break barriers and molds and performing very well. So just wanted to steal that point that you've made before.
Yeah, and I would say that the F-16 and the F-15 were so successful because they were forward-leaning departures from the F-4. So you wouldn't want a F-4 plus. So I've flown with the Korean F-4s back in 2012, and they really did not have much situational awareness at all. So I think the reason those planes were successful is because they were forward leaning departures, which is going to give some issues early on, but they've been massively successful. And I would say the F-16 is probably the greatest fighter ever built, looking at its mission sets and the effectiveness it's had.
Awesome. So with that, it's been an awesome discussion. Stutz, Heather, and Hazard, I just want to say thanks so much for coming onto the show today. It's been really interesting, and I look forward to the next time we get to talk.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Slick. Check six. Talk to you later.
Slick, as always, it's great to join you and great to be with Stutz and Hazard. Thank you.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.